Chapter 12. Kantaka. Yasodhara quickly regained her strength and soon was able to return to her work, while also spending much time with baby Rahula. One spring day, at Queen Gotami's insistence, Chana drove Siddhartha and Yasodhara out into the countryside for an outing. They brought Rahula along and a young servant girl named Ratna to help care for him. Pleasant sunlight streamed down upon tender green leaves. Birds sang on the blossoming branches of ashok and rose-apple trees. Chana let the horses trot at a leisurely pace. Country folk, recognizing Siddhartha and Yasodhara, stood and waved in greeting. When they approached the banks of the Banganga River, Chana pulled on the reins and brought the carriage to a sudden halt. Blocking the road before them was a man who had collapsed. His arms and legs were pulled in toward his chest, and his whole body shook. Moans escaped from his half-open mouth. Siddhartha jumped down, followed by Chana. The man lying in the road looked less than 30 years old. Siddhartha picked up his hand and said to Chana, "It looks as though he's come down with a bad flu, don't you think? Let's massage him and see if it helps." Chana shook his head. "Your Highness, these aren't the symptoms of a bad flu. I'm afraid he's contracted something far worse. This is a disease for which there is no known cure." "Are you sure?" Siddhartha gazed at the man. "Couldn't we take him to the royal physician?" "Your Highness, even the royal physician can't cure this disease. I've heard this disease is highly infectious. If we take him in our carriage, he might infect your wife and son, and even yourself. Please, Your Highness, for your own safety, let go of his hand." But Siddhartha did not release the man's hand. He looked at it, and then at his own. Siddhartha had always enjoyed good health, but now, looking at the dying man no older than himself, all he had taken for granted suddenly vanished. From the riverbank came cries of mourning. He heard a funeral taking place. There was the funeral pyre. The sound of chanting intertwined with the grief-stricken cries and the crackling of fire as the funeral pyre was lit. Looking again at the man, Siddhartha saw that he had stopped breathing. His glassy eyes stared upward. Siddhartha released his hand and quietly closed the eyes. When Siddhartha stood up, Yasodhara was standing close behind him. How long she had been there, he did not know. She spoke softly. "Please, my husband, go and wash your hands in the river. Chana, you do the same. Then we will drive into the next village and notify the authorities so they can take care of the body." Afterward, no one had the heart to continue their spring outing. Siddhartha asked Chana to turn around, and on the way back, no one spoke a word. That night, Yasodhara's sleep was disturbed by three strange dreams. In the first, she saw a white cow on whose head was a sparkling jewel as bright as the North Star. The cow strolled through Kapilavatu, headed for the city gates. From the altar of Indra resounded a divine voice. "If you can't keep this cow, there will be no light left in all the capital." Everyone in the city began chasing after the cow, yet no one was able to detain it. It walked out of the city gates and disappeared. In her second dream, Yasodhara watched four god-kings of the skies atop Mount Sumeru, projecting a light onto the city of Kapilavatu. Suddenly, the flag mounted on Indra's altar flapped violently and fell to the ground. Flowers of every color dropped like rain from the skies, and the sound of celestial singing echoed everywhere throughout the capital. In her third dream, Yasodhara heard a loud voice that shook the heavens. "The time has come! The time has come!" it cried. Frightened, she looked over at Siddhartha's chair to discover he was gone. The jasmine flowers tucked in her hair fell to the floor and turned to dust. The garments and ornaments which Siddhartha had left on his chair transformed into a snake that slithered out the door. Yasodhara was filled with panic. All at once, she heard the bellowing of the white cow from beyond the city gates, the flapping of the flag upon Indra's altar, and the voices of heaven shouting, "The time has come! The time has come!" Yasodhara awoke. Her forehead was drenched with sweat. She turned to Siddhartha and shook him. "Siddhartha, Siddhartha, please wake up!" He was already awake. He stroked her hair to comfort her and asked, "What did you dream, Gopa? Tell me." She recounted all three dreams and then asked him, "Are these dreams an omen that you will soon leave me in order to go and seek the way?" Siddhartha fell silent, then consoled her. "Gopa, please don't worry. You are a woman of depth. You are my partner, the one who can help me to truly fulfill my quest. You understand me more than anyone else. If in the near future I must leave and travel far from you, I know you possess the courage to continue your work. You will care for and raise our child well. Though I am gone, though I am far away from you, my love for you remains the same. I will never stop loving you, Gopa. With that knowledge, you will be able to endure our separation. And when I have found the way, I will return to you and to our child. Please, now, try to get some rest." Siddhartha's words, spoken so tenderly, penetrated Yasodhara's heart. Comforted, she closed her eyes and slept. The following morning, Siddhartha went to speak to his father. "My royal father, I ask your permission to leave home and become a monk in order to seek the path of enlightenment." King Suddhodana was greatly alarmed. Though he had long known this day might arrive, he had certainly not expected it to take place so abruptly. After a long moment, he looked at his son and answered, "In the history of our family, a few have become monks, but no one has ever done it at your age. They all waited until they were past 50. Why can't you wait? Your son is still small, and the whole country is relying on you. Father, a day upon the throne would be like a day of sitting on a bed of hot coals for me. If my heart has no peace, how can I fulfill your or the people's trust in me? I have seen how quickly time passes, and I know my youth is no different. Please grant me your permission." The king tried to dissuade his son. "You must think of your homeland, your parents. Infant. Father, it is precisely because I do think of all of you that I now ask your permission to go. It is not that I wish to abandon my responsibilities. Father, you know that you cannot free me from the suffering in my heart any more than you can release the suffering in your own heart." The king stood up and grabbed his son's hand. "Siddhartha, you know how much I need you. You are the one on whom I have placed all my hopes. Please, don't abandon me." "I will never abandon you. I am only asking you to let me go away for a time. When I have found the way, I will return." A look of pain crossed King Suddhodana's face. He said no more and retired to his quarters. Later on, Queen Gotami came to spend the day with Yasodhara, and in the early evening, Udayin, one of Siddhartha's friends, came to visit with Devadatta, Ananda, Bhadya, Anuruddha, Kimbila, and Bhadrika. Udayin had organized a party and had hired one of the finest dancing troupes in the capital to perform. Festive torches brightened the palace. Gotami told Yasodhara that Udayin had been summoned by the king and given the task to do everything he could think of to entice Siddhartha to remain in the palace. The evening's party was the first of Udayin's plans. Yasodhara instructed her attendants to prepare food and drinks for all the guests before retiring to her quarters with Gotami. Siddhartha himself went out and welcomed his guests. It was the full moon day of the month of Uttarasala. As the music began, the moon appeared above a row of trees in the southeastern sky. Gotami confided her thoughts to Yasodhara until it was late, and then excused herself to return to her own residence. Yasodhara walked with her to the veranda, where she saw the full moon now suspended high in the night sky. The party was still in full swing. Sounds of music, talking, and laughter drifted from within. Yasodhara led Gotami to the front gate and then went on her own to find Channa. He was already asleep when she found him. Yasodhara awoke him and whispered, "It is possible the prince will require your services tonight. Prepare Kantaka to ride, and saddle another horse for yourself." "Your Highness, where is the prince going?" "Please, don't ask. Just do as I have said, because the prince may need to ride tonight." Channa nodded and entered the stable, while Yasodhara returned inside the palace. She readied clothes suitable for traveling and placed them on Siddhartha's chair. She took a light blanket to cover Rahula and then lay upon the bed herself. As she lay there, she listened to the sounds of music, talking and laughter. It was a long time before the sounds faded, then disappeared. She knew the guests had retired to their quarters. Yasodhara lay quietly as silence returned to the palace. She waited a long time, but Siddhartha did not return to their room. He was sitting alone outside, gazing at the radiant moon and stars. A thousand stars twinkled. He had made up his mind to leave the palace that very night. At long last, he entered his chamber and changed into the traveling clothes awaiting him there. He pulled back the curtain and gazed upon the bed. Gopa was lying there, no doubt asleep. Ahula was by her side. Siddhartha wanted to enter and speak words of parting to Yasodhara, but he hesitated. He had already said everything that was essential. If he woke her now, it would only make their parting more painful. He let the curtain drop and turned to leave. Again, he hesitated. Once more, he lifted back the curtain to take a last look at his wife and son. He looked at them deeply, as though to imprint on his memory that familiar and beloved scene. Then he released the curtain and walked out. As he passed the guest hall, Siddhartha saw the slumbering dancing girls sprawled across the carpets. Their hair was undone and disheveled, their mouths hanging open like dead fish. Their arms, so soft and supple during the dance, now looked as stiff as boards. Their legs were tangled across each other's bodies like victims on a battlefield. Siddhartha felt as though he were crossing a cemetery. He made his way to the stables and found Chana still awake. "Chana, please saddle and bring Kantaka to me." Chana nodded. He had prepared everything. Kantaka was already bridled and saddled. Chana asked, "May I accompany you, Prince?" Siddhartha nodded, and Chana entered the stable for his own horse. They led the horses out of the palace grounds. Siddhartha stopped and stroked Kantaka's mane. "Kantaka," he spoke, "this is a most important night. You must give me your best for this journey." He mounted Kantaka, and Chana mounted his horse. They walked them to avoid making any loud noise. The guards were fast asleep, and they passed through the city gates easily. Once well beyond the city gates, Siddhartha turned for a last look at the capital, now lying quietly beneath the moonlight. It was there that Siddhartha had been born and raised, the city where he had experienced so many joys and sorrows, so many anxieties and aspirations. In the same city now slept everyone close to him, his father, Gotami, Yasodhara, Rahula, and all the others. He whispered to himself, "If I do not find the way, I will not return to Kapilavatu." He turned his horse toward the south, and Kantaka broke into a full gallop. Chapter 13. Beginning Spiritual Practice. Even at a full gallop, they did not reach the border of Sakya until daybreak. Before them flowed the Anuma River, which they followed downstream until they found a shallow place to cross over with the horses. They rode for another spell before coming to the edge of a forest. A deer flitted in and out among the trees. Birds flew close by, undisturbed by the men's presence. Siddhartha dismounted. He smiled and stroked Kantaka's mane. "Kantaka, you are wonderful. You have helped bring me here, and for that I thank you." The horse lifted his head and looked lovingly at his master. Siddhartha pulled out a sword tucked in his horse's saddle, and then grasping his own long locks of hair in his left hand, cut them off with his right. Chana dismounted his own horse. Siddhartha handed him the hair and sword. He then removed his jeweled necklace. "Chana, take my necklace, sword, and hair, and give them to my father. Please tell him to have faith in me. I have not left home to selfishly avoid my responsibilities. I go now on behalf of all of you and all beings. Please console the king and queen for me. Console Yasodhara. I ask this of you." As Chana took the necklace, tears streamed from his eyes. "Your Highness, everyone will suffer terribly. I don't know what I will say to the king and queen or to your wife Yasodhara. Your Highness, how will you sleep beneath the trees like an ascetic when all your life you've known nothing but a warm bed and soft blankets?" Siddhartha smiled. "Don't worry, Chana. I can live the way others do. You must return to tell everyone of my decision before they begin to worry about my disappearance. Leave me here alone now. Chana wiped his tears. Please, your highness, let me stay here to serve you. Have mercy on me, and don't make me bear such sorrowful news to ones I love. Siddhartha patted his attendant on the shoulder. His voice grew serious. Chana, I need you to return and inform my family. If you truly care for me, please do as I say. I don't need you here, Chana. No monk has need of a personal attendant. Please, return home now. Chana reluctantly obeyed the prince. He carefully placed the hair and necklace inside his jacket and tucked the sword in Kantaka's saddle. He grasped Siddhartha's arm in his two hands and beseeched him. I will do as you say, but please, your highness, remember me. Remember us all. Don't forget to return after you have found the way. Siddhartha nodded and smiled reassuringly at Chana. He stroked Kantaka's head. Kantaka, my friend, now return home. Chana held Kantaka's reins and mounted his own steed. Kantaka turned to look at Siddhartha one last time, his eyes filled with tears no less than Chana's. Siddhartha waited until Chana and the two horses were out of sight before he turned toward the forest to enter his new life. The sky would now serve as his roof and the forest as his home. A sense of ease and contentment welled within him. Just at that moment, a man came walking out of the forest. At first glance, Siddhartha thought he was a monk, for he was wearing the customary robe. But on closer inspection, Siddhartha saw the man was carrying a bow, and a quiver of arrows was slung across his back. You are a hunter, are you not? Asked Siddhartha. That is correct, the man answered. If you are a hunter, why are you dressed as a monk? The hunter smiled and said, Thanks to this robe, the animals do not fear me, and I am thus easily able to shoot them. Siddhartha shook his head. Then you are abusing the compassion of those who follow a spiritual path. Would you agree to trade your robe for my garments? The hunter looked at Siddhartha and saw he was wearing royal garments of inestimable value. Do you really want to trade? The hunter asked. Absolutely, said Siddhartha. You could sell these garments and have enough money to stop hunting and begin a new trade. As for me, I wish to be a monk and have need of a robe like yours. The hunter was overjoyed, and after exchanging his robe for Siddhartha's handsome clothes, he hurried off. Siddhartha now had the appearance of a real monk. He stepped into the forest and found a tree to sit beneath. For the first time as a homeless monk, he sat in meditation. After a long final day in the palace and an autumn night spent on the back of a horse, Siddhartha now experienced a marvelous ease. He sat in meditation to savor and nurture the feeling of release and freedom that had filled him the moment he entered the forest. Sunlight filtered through the trees and came to rest on Siddhartha's eyelashes. He opened his eyes and saw standing before him a monk. The monk's face and body were thin and worn by a life of austerities. Siddhartha stood up and joined his palms together in greeting. He told the monk he had only just abandoned his home and had not yet had the chance to be accepted by any teacher. He expressed his intent to travel south to find the spiritual center of Master Alarakalama and there ask to be accepted as a disciple. The monk told Siddhartha that he himself had studied under Master Alarakalama and that at present the master had started a center just north of the city of Asali. More than 400 disciples were gathered there for his teaching. The monk knew how to get there and said he would be glad to take Siddhartha. Siddhartha followed him through the forest to a path which wound up a hill and entered another forest. They walked until noon, when the monk showed Siddhartha how to gather wild fruits and edible greens. The monk explained that it was sometimes necessary to dig roots to eat when there were no edible fruits or greens to be found. Siddhartha knew he would be living in the forest a long time, and so he asked the names of all the edible foods and carefully noted everything the monk told him. He learned that the monk was an ascetic who lived on nothing but wild fruits, greens, and roots. His name was Bhargava. He told Siddhartha that Master Alarakalama was now an ascetic, and in addition to wild foraging, his monks begged for food or accepted what was brought as offerings to them from neighboring villages. 9 days later, they reached the forest center of Alarakalama, near Anupaya. They arrived as Master Alara was giving a talk to more than 400 disciples. He looked about 70 years old, and though he appeared thin and frail, his eyes shone and his voice resounded like a copper drum. Siddhartha and his companions stood outside the circle of disciples and quietly listened to the Master's teaching. When he finished speaking, his disciples scattered throughout the forest to pursue their practice. Siddhartha approached him, and after introducing himself, respectfully said, "Venerable teacher, I ask you to accept me as one of your disciples. I wish to live and study under your guidance." The Master listened and looked intently at Siddhartha, and then expressed his approval. "Siddhartha, I would be happy to accept you. You may stay here. If you practice according to my teachings and methods, you will realize the teachings in a short time." Siddhartha prostrated himself to express his happiness. Master Alara lived in a straw hut made for him by several of his disciples. Scattered here and there in the forest were the straw huts of his followers. That night, Siddhartha found a level place to sleep, using a tree root for his pillow. Because he was exhausted from the long journey, he slept soundly until morning. When he awoke, the sun had already risen, and the songs of birds filled the forest. He sat up. The other monks had finished their morning meditation and were preparing to go down into the city to beg for food. Siddhartha was given a bowl and shown how to beg. Following the other monks, he held his bowl and entered the city of Vesali. Holding a bowl to beg for the first time, Siddhartha was struck by how closely linked the life of a monk was to that of the laity. The monks were dependent on the lay community for food. He learned how to hold his bowl properly, how to walk and stand, how to receive the food offerings, and how to recite prayers in order to thank those who made the offerings. That day, Siddhartha received some rice with curry sauce. He returned with his new companions to the forest, and they all sat down to eat. When he had finished, he went to Master Alara to receive spiritual instruction. Alara was sitting in deep meditation when Siddhartha found him, and so he sat down before the Master, quietly trying to focus his own mind. After a long time, Alara opened his eyes. Siddhartha prostrated himself and asked Master Alara to teach him. Alara spoke to the new monk about faith and diligence, and showed him how to use his breathing to develop concentration. He explained, "My teaching is not a mere theory. Knowledge is gained from direct experience and direct attainment, not from mental arguments. In order to attain different states of meditation, it is necessary to rid yourself of all thoughts of past and future. You must focus on nothing but liberation." Siddhartha asked about how to control the body and the sensations, and then respectfully thanked his teacher, and walked away slowly to find a place in the forest where he could practice. He gathered branches and leaves and constructed a small hut beneath a sal tree, where his meditation practice could ripen. He practiced diligently, and every 5 or 6 days he returned to ask Alara's advice concerning whatever difficulties he was experiencing. In a short time, Siddhartha made considerable progress. While sitting in meditation, he was able to let go of thoughts, and even of clinging to his past and future, and he attained a state of wondrous serenity and rapture, although he felt the seeds of thought and attachment still present in him. Several weeks later, Siddhartha reached a higher state of meditation, and the seeds of thought and attachment dissolved. Then he entered a state of concentration in which both rapture and non-rapture ceased to exist. It felt to him as though the 5 doors of sense perception had completely closed, and his heart was as still as a lake on a windless day. When he presented the fruits of his practice to Master Alara, the teacher was impressed. He told Siddhartha that he had made remarkable progress in a short time, and he taught Siddhartha how to realize the meditative state called the realm of limitless space, in which the mind becomes one with infinity. All material and visual phenomena cease to arise, and space is seen as the limitless source of all things. Siddhartha followed his teacher's instructions and concentrated his efforts on achieving that state, and in less than 3 days he succeeded. But Siddhartha still felt that even the ability to experience infinite space had not liberated him from his deepest anxieties and sorrows. Dwelling in such a state of awareness, he still felt hindrances, so he returned to Alara for assistance. The master told him, "You must go one step further. The realm of limitless space is of the same essence as your own mind. It is not an object of your consciousness, but your very consciousness itself. Now you must experience the realm of limitless consciousness." Siddhartha returned to his spot in the forest, and in just 2 days, he realized the realm of limitless consciousness. He saw that his own mind was present in every phenomenon in the universe. But even with this attainment, he still felt oppressed by his deepest afflictions and anxieties. So Siddhartha returned to Master Alara and explained his difficulty. The master looked at him with eyes of deep respect and said, "You are very close to the final goal. Return to your hut and meditate on the illusory nature of all phenomena. Everything in the universe is created by our own mind. Our mind is the source of all phenomena. Form, sound, smell, taste, and tactile perception, such as hot and cold, hard and soft, these are all creations of our mind. They do not exist as we usually think they do. Our consciousness is like an artist, painting every phenomenon into being. Once you have attained the state of the realm of no materiality, you will have succeeded. The realm of no materiality is the state in which we see that no phenomenon exists outside of our own mind." The young monk joined his palms to express his gratitude to his teacher and returned to his corner of the forest. While Siddhartha studied with Alara Kalama, he made the acquaintance of many other monks. Everyone was attracted by Siddhartha's kind and pleasant manner. Often before Siddhartha had a chance to seek food for himself, he found food waiting for him by his hut. When he came out of meditation, he would find a few bananas or a rice ball secretly left for him by another monk. Many monks liked to befriend Siddhartha in order to learn from him, as they had heard their own master praise Siddhartha's progress. Master Alara had once asked about Siddhartha's background, and so learned of Siddhartha's life as a prince. But Siddhartha only smiled when other monks asked him about his royal past. He answered modestly, "It's nothing of importance. It would be best if we spoke only about our experiences of practicing the way." In less than a month, Siddhartha attained the state of the realm of no materiality. Happy to have achieved this state of awareness, he spent the following weeks trying to use it to dissolve the deepest obstructions in his mind and heart. But although the realm of no materiality was a profound state of meditation, it too was unable to help him. Finally, he returned to ask the advice of Master Alara Kalama. Alara Kalama sat and listened intently to Siddhartha. His eyes shone. Expressing deepest respect and praise, he said, "Monk Siddhartha, you are profoundly gifted. You have attained the highest level I can teach. All I have attained, you have attained as well. Let us join together to guide and lead this community of monks." Siddhartha was silent as he contemplated Alara's invitation. While the realm of no materiality was a precious fruit of meditation, it did not help resolve the fundamental problem of birth and death, nor did it liberate one from all suffering and anxiety. It did not lead to total liberation. Siddhartha's goal was not to become the leader of a community, but to find the path of true liberation. Siddhartha joined his palms and answered, "Venerable teacher, the state of the realm of no materiality is not the final goal I am seeking. Please accept my gratitude for your support and care. But now I must ask your permission to leave the community in order to seek the way elsewhere. You have taught me with all your heart these past months, and I will be forever grateful to you." Master Alara Kalama looked disappointed, but Siddhartha had made up his mind. The next day, Siddhartha again took to the road. Chapter 14. Crossing the Ganga. Siddhartha crossed the Ganges River, known as Ganga, and entered deep into the kingdom of Magadha. a region renowned for its accomplished spiritual teachers. He was determined to find someone who could teach him how to overcome birth and death. Most of the spiritual teachers lived in remote mountains or forests. Tirelessly, Siddhartha learned the whereabouts of these masters and sought out each of them, no matter how many mountains and valleys he had to cross. He continued his search through rain and sun from 1 month to the next. Siddhartha met ascetics who refused to wear any clothes, and others who refused to accept any food offerings, living only on the fruits, greens, and roots that grew wild in the forests. Exposing their bodies to the elements, these ascetics believed that by enduring extreme austerities, they would enter heaven after they died. One day, Siddhartha said to them, "Even if you are reborn in heaven, the suffering on earth will remain unchanged. To seek the way is to find the solution to life's sufferings, not to escape life. Granted, we cannot accomplish much if we pamper our bodies like those who live for sensual pleasure, but abusing our bodies is no more helpful." Siddhartha continued his search, remaining in some spiritual centers for 3 months and in others for 6. His powers of meditation and concentration increased, but he was still unable to find the true path of liberation from birth to death. The months passed quickly, and soon it was more than 3 years since Siddhartha had left home. Sometimes, as he sat in meditation in the forest, images arose in Siddhartha's mind of his father, Yasodhara and Rahula, and of his childhood and youth. Although it was difficult for him to avoid feeling impatient and discouraged, his strong faith that he would find the way allowed him to continue his search. During one period, Siddhartha dwelled alone on the hillside of Pandava, not far from the capital city of Rajagaha. One day he took his bowl and went down the hillside to beg in the capital. His walk was slow and dignified, his countenance serene and resolute. People on both sides of the street stopped to gaze at this monk who walked as elegantly as a lion passing through a mountain forest. The royal carriage of King Bimbisara of Mogoda happened to pass by, and the king ordered his driver to stop so that he could have a good look at Siddhartha. He asked his attendant to offer the monk food and to follow him to see where he lived. The next afternoon, King Bimbisara rode to Siddhartha's dwelling. Leaving his carriage at the foot of the hill, he mounted the path with one of his attendants. When he saw Siddhartha sitting beneath a tree, he approached to greet him. Siddhartha stood up. He could tell by his visitor's dress that he was the king of Magadha. Siddhartha joined his palms together and then motioned for the king to sit on a large rock nearby. Siddhartha sat on another rock and faced the king. King Bimbisara was noticeably impressed by the monk's noble bearing and elevated manner. He said, "I am the king of Magadha. I wish to invite you to come to the capital with me. I would like you by my side so that I may benefit from your teaching and virtue. With you at my side, I am sure the kingdom of Magadha will enjoy peace and prosperity." Siddhartha smiled. "Great king, I am more used to living in the forest. This is too harsh a life. You have no bed, no attendant to assist you. If you agree to come with me, I will give you your own palace. Please return with me to teach." "Great king, palace life is not well suited to me. I am endeavoring to find a path of liberation to free myself and all beings from suffering. Palace life is not compatible with the heart's quest of this monk." "You are still young as I am. I have need of a friend with whom I can truly share. From the moment I saw you, I felt a natural connection with you. Come with me. If you accept, I will reserve half of my kingdom for you. And when you are older, you can return to the life of a monk. It won't be too late." "I thank you for your generous heart and offer of patronage, but I truly have but one desire, and that is to find the path that can liberate all beings from suffering. Time passes quickly, great king. If I don't use the strength and energy I now possess as a young man, old age will arrive too soon, and I will feel deep regret. Life is so uncertain. Sickness or death can occur at any moment. The flames of inner turmoil caused by greed, anger, hatred, passion, jealousy, and pride continue to burn in my heart. Only when the great way is discovered will liberation be possible for all beings. If you truly feel affection for me, You will allow me to continue the path I have long pursued." King Bimbisara was even more impressed after hearing Siddhartha speak. He said, "It gives me great joy to hear your words so filled with determination. Dear monk, allow me to ask where you are from and what your family name is." "Great king, I come from the kingdom of Sakya. My family name is Sakya. King Suddhodana, who presently rules in Kapilavatu, is my father, and my mother was Queen Mahamaya. I was the prince, heir to the throne, but because I wished to become a monk in order to seek the way, I left my parents, wife, and son more than 3 years ago." King Bimbisara was astonished. "Then you yourself are of royal blood. I am most honored to meet you, noble monk. The royal families of Sakya and Magadha have long been on very close terms. How foolish of me to try to impress you with my position and wealth in order to persuade you to return with me. Please forgive me. Let me ask only this. From time to time, come to my palace and allow me to offer you food. And when you have found the great way, return in compassion to teach me as your disciple. Will you promise that?" Siddhartha joined his palms and answered, "I promise that when I have discovered the path, I will return to share it with your highness." King Bimbisara bowed low before Siddhartha and returned down the hill with his attendant. Later that day, the monk Gautama abandoned his dwelling place to avoid the interruptions he feared would result from the young king bringing frequent offerings. Heading south, he looked for another place conducive to practice. He learned of the spiritual center of Udakaramaputta, a great teacher who was said to have attained very deep levels of understanding. 300 monks were in residence at his center, located not far from Rajagaha, and 400 other disciples practiced nearby. Siddhartha made his way there. Chapter 15. Forest Ascetic. Master Udaka was 75 years old. He was venerated by all as though he were a living god. Udaka required all new disciples to begin at the most elementary levels of practice. So Siddhartha began again with the simplest meditation techniques. But in just a few weeks, he demonstrated to his new teacher that he had already attained to the realm of no materiality, and Master Udaka was impressed. He saw in this young man of noble bearing a potential spiritual heir, and he taught Siddhartha with utmost care. "Monk Siddhartha Gautama, in the state of no materiality, emptiness is no longer the same as empty space, nor is it what is usually called consciousness. All that remains are perception and the object of perception. Thus the path to liberation is to transcend all perception." Siddhartha respectfully asked, "Master, if one eliminates perception, what is left? If there is no perception, how do we differ from a piece of wood or a rock?" "A piece of wood or a rock is not without perception. Inanimate objects are themselves perception. You must arrive at a state of consciousness in which both perception and non-perception are eliminated. This is the state of neither perception nor non-perception. Young man, you must now attain that state." Siddhartha left to return to his meditation. In just 15 days, he realized the samadhi called neither perception nor non-perception. Siddhartha saw that this state allowed one to transcend all ordinary states of consciousness. But whenever he came out of this meditative state, he saw that in spite of its extraordinariness, it did not provide a problem of life and death. It was a most peaceful state to dwell in, but it was not the key to unlock reality. When Siddhartha returned to Master Udaka Ramaputta, the master praised him highly. He grasped Siddhartha's hand and said, "Monk Gautama, you are the best student I have ever had. You have made enormous progress in such a short time. You have attained the highest level I have. I am old and not long for this world. If you will remain here, we can guide this community together, and when I die, you can take my place as master of the community." Once again, Siddhartha politely declined. He knew that the state of neither perception nor non-perception was not the key to liberation from birth and death, and that he had to move on. He expressed his deepest gratitude to the master and to the community of monks, and took his leave. Everyone had come to love Siddhartha, and all were sad to see him go. During his stay at Udaka Ramaputta Center, Siddhartha made friends with a young monk named Kondana. Kondana was very fond of Siddhartha and regarded him as a teacher as well as a good friend. No one else in the community except Siddhartha had attained the state of no materiality, not to mention the state of neither perception nor non-perception. Kondana knew that the master considered Siddhartha worthy to be his spiritual heir. Just looking at Siddhartha gave Kondana faith in his own practice. He often approached Siddhartha to learn from him, and a special bond grew between them. Kondana regretted his friend's departure. He accompanied Siddhartha down the mountain and waited until he was no longer in sight before returning back up the mountain. Siddhartha had accomplished so much with the masters reputed to be the two best meditation teachers in the land. Yet the fundamental issue of liberation from suffering was still burning inside him. He realized that he probably would not be able to learn much more from any of the other teacher sages throughout the land, and so he knew that he had to seek the key to enlightenment on his own. Walking slowly west, between rice fields and across a long stretch of muddy lagoons and streams, Siddhartha reached the Niranjara River. He waded across it and walked until he reached Dangsiri Mountain, half a day's walk from Uruvela village. The steep and rocky slopes ended in saw-toothed peaks and concealed many caves. Boulders as large as the homes of poor villagers perched on the mountainside. Siddhartha resolved to remain here until he discovered the way to liberation. He found a cave in which he could sit in meditation for long hours, and while sitting, he reviewed all the practices he had done for what was now more than 5 years. He remembered how he had advised the ascetics not to abuse their bodies, telling them that that would only add to the suffering of a world already filled with suffering. But now, as he considered their path more carefully, he thought to himself, "You can't make a fire with soft, wet wood. The body is the same. If physical desires are not mastered, it is difficult for the heart to attain enlightenment. I will practice self-mortification in order to attain liberation." Thus, the monk Gautama began a period of extreme asceticism. On dark nights, he entered the deepest and most wild reaches of the forest, the mere thought of which was enough to make a person's hair stand on end, and there he remained throughout the night. Even as fear and panic engulfed his mind and body, he sat without stirring. When a deer approached with its rustling sounds, his fear told him that these were demons coming to kill him. But he did not budge. When a peacock broke a piece of dead twig, his fear told him it was a python coming down from a tree. Yet he still did not move, even as fear shot through him like the sting of red ants. He tried to overcome all physical fears. He believed that once his body was no longer enslaved by fear, his mind would break the chains of suffering. Sometimes he sat with his teeth clenched while pressing his tongue against the roof of his mouth, using his willpower to suppress all fear and horror. Even when he broke into a cold sweat and his whole body became drenched, he did not move. At other times he held his breath for long stretches until a roar like thunder or a blazing furnace pounded in his ears, and his head felt as though someone had taken an axe and cleaved it in two. Sometimes he felt as though his head was being squeezed by a steel band and his stomach slashed open like a goat's by a butcher. And at times, he felt as if his body was being roasted over an open fire. Through these austere practices, he was able to consolidate his courage and discipline, and his body was able to endure unspeakable pain, but his heart was still without peace. The monk Gautama practiced austerities in this way for 6 months. For the first 3 of these months, he was alone on the mountain. But during the 4th month, he was discovered by 5 disciples of Master Udaka Ramaputta, led by his old friend Kondana. Siddhartha was happy to see Kondana again, and he found out that just 1 month after Siddhartha left the meditation center, Kondana himself had attained the state of neither perception nor non-perception. Seeing there was nothing more he could learn from Master Udaka, Kondana persuaded 4 friends to join him in seeking Siddhartha. A After several weeks, they were lucky enough to find him, and they expressed their desire to stay and practice with him. Siddhartha explained to them why he was exploring the path of self-mortification. And the five young men, Koldana, Vapa, Badiya, Asaji, and Mahanama, resolved to join him. Each monk found a cave to live in, not far from one another, and every day one of them went into town to beg for food. When he returned, the food was divided into six portions, so that none of them had more than a small handful each day. Days and months went by, and the six monks grew thin and gaunt. They left the mountain and moved east toward the village of Uruvela, on the bank of the Niranjara, and continued to practice in the same way. But Siddhartha's austerities began to alarm even his five companions, and they found it impossible to keep up with him. Siddhartha ceased bathing in the river, or even taking his share of the food. On some days he ate just a shriveled guava he happened to find on the ground, or a piece of dried buffalo manure. His body had become terribly wasted. It was little more than loose flesh hanging on protruding bones. He had not cut his hair or beard in 6 months, and when he rubbed his head, handfuls of hair fell out, as though there was no longer any space for it to grow and the bit of flesh still clinging to his skull. And then one day, while practicing sitting meditation in a cemetery, Siddhartha realized with a jolt how wrong the path of self-mortification was. The sun had set, and a cool breeze gently caressed his skin. After sitting all day beneath the blazing sun, the breeze was delightfully refreshing, and Siddhartha experienced an ease in his mind unlike anything he had felt during the day. He realized that body and mind formed one reality which could not be separated. The peace and comfort of the body were directly related to the peace and comfort of the mind. To abuse the body was to abuse the mind. He remembered the first time he sat in meditation when he was 9 years old, beneath the cool shade of a rose-apple tree on the day of the year's first plowing. He remembered how the refreshing ease of that sitting had brought him a sense of clarity and calm. He recalled as well his meditation in the forest right after Chana had left him. He thought back to his first days with Master Alarakalama. Those initial sessions of meditation had nourished both body and mind, creating in him a deep ability to concentrate and focus. But after that, Master Alarakalama had told him to transcend the joys of meditation in order to attain to states that existed beyond the material world, states such as the realms of limitless space and limitless consciousness, and the state of no materiality. Later, there had been the state of neither perception nor non-perception. Always the goal had been to find a means to escape the world of feeling and thought, the world of sensation and perception. He asked himself, why follow only the traditions laid down in Scripture? Why fear the joyful ease that meditation brings? Such joys have nothing in common with the five categories of desire that obscure awareness. To the contrary, the joys of meditation can nourish body and mind and provide the strength needed to pursue the path to enlightenment. The monk Gautama resolved to regain his health and to use his meditation to nourish both body and mind. He would beg for food again starting the next morning. He would be his own teacher, not depending on the teachings of anyone else. Happy with this decision, he stretched out on a mound of earth and peacefully drifted off to sleep. The full moon had just risen in a cloudless sky, and the Milky Way stretched clear and radiant across the heavens. The monk Gautama awoke the next morning to the sound of birds singing. He stood up and recalled his decisions of the previous night. He was covered with dirt and dust, and his robe was so tattered and threadbare it no longer covered his body. He remembered seeing a corpse in the cemetery the day before, and he guessed that today or tomorrow people would lift it down to the river to perform the cremation ceremony, and the brick-colored cloth that covered it would no longer be needed. He approached the corpse and reflected on birth and death, respectfully removed the cloth from the body. The corpse was that of a young woman, her body swollen and discolored. Siddhartha would use the brick-colored cloth as a new robe. He walked to the river to bathe himself at the same time to wash the cloth. The water was cool, and Siddhartha found it overwhelmingly refreshing. He enjoyed the pleasant feeling of the water on his skin, welcoming the sensation with a new state of mind. He took a long time bathing, and then he scrubbed and wrung out his new robe. But as he went to climb out of the water, his strength failed him. He did not have enough energy to pull himself onto the bank. He stood quietly and breathed calmly. To one side, he saw a tree branch leaning over the water, its leaves skimming the surface. He walked toward it slowly and grabbed onto it to support himself while he climbed out of the water. He sat down to rest on the riverbank as the sun climbed higher into the sky. He spread out the cloth to dry in the hot sun, and when the cloth was dry, Siddhartha wrapped it around himself and set out for the village of Uruvela. But before he had walked even halfway, his strength failed him, and unable to catch his breath, he collapsed. He lay unconscious for some time before a young girl from the village appeared. 13-year-old Sujata had been sent by her mother to carry rice milk, cakes, and lotus seeds to offer to the forest gods. When she saw the monk lying unconscious on the road, barely breathing, she knelt down and placed a bowl of milk to his lips. She knew he was an ascetic who had fainted from weakness. When the drops of milk moistened his tongue and throat, Siddhartha responded immediately. He could taste how refreshing the milk was, and he slowly drank the entire bowlful. After a few dozen breaths, he was revived enough to sit up, and he motioned Sujata to pour him another bowlful of milk. It was remarkable how quickly the milk restored his strength. That day, he decided to abandon austerity practice and go to the cool forest across the river to practice there. During the days that followed, he gradually began to eat and drink normally. Sometimes Sujata brought him food offerings. Sometimes he took his bowl into the village to beg. Every day he practiced walking meditation along the riverbank, and the rest of the time he devoted to sitting meditation. Every evening he bathed in the Naranjara River. He abandoned all reliance on tradition and scripture in order to find the way on his own. He returned to himself to learn from his own successes and failures. He did not hesitate to let meditation nourish his mind and body, and a sense of peace and ease grew within him. He did not distance himself or try to escape his feelings and perceptions, but maintained mindfulness in order to observe them as they arose. He abandoned the desire to escape the world of phenomena, and as he returned to himself, he found he was completely present to the world of phenomena. One breath, one bird's song, one leaf, one ray of sunlight, any of these might serve as his subject of meditation. He began to see that the key to liberation lay in each breath, each step, each small pebble along the path. The monk Gautama went from meditating on his body to meditating on his feelings, and from meditating on his feelings to meditating on his perceptions, including all the thoughts that rose and fell in his own mind. He saw the oneness of body and mind, that each and every cell of the body contained all the wisdom of the universe. He saw that he needed only to look deeply into a speck of dust to see the true face of the entire universe, that the speck of dust was itself the universe, and if it did not exist, the universe could not exist either. The monk Gautama went beyond the idea of a separate self, of Atman, and with a start realized that he had long been dominated by a false view of Atman as expounded in the Vedas. In reality, all things were without a separate self. Non-self, or Anatman, was the nature of all existence. Anatman was not a term to describe some new entity. It was a thunderbolt that destroyed all wrong views. Taking hold of non-self, Siddhartha was like a general raising his sharp sword of insight on the battlefield of meditation practice. Day and night he sat beneath the papala tree, as new levels of awareness awoke in him like bright flashes of lightning. During this time, Siddhartha's five friends lost faith in him. They saw him sitting along the riverbank eating food offerings. They watched him speak and smile to a young girl, enjoy milk and rice, and carry his ball down into the village. Kondana said to the others, Siddhartha is no longer someone we can rely on. He has abandoned the path halfway. He now concerns himself only with idly feeding his body. We should leave him and seek another place to continue our practice. I see no reason to continue here. Only after his five friends had departed did Siddhartha notice their absence. Encouraged by his new insights, Siddhartha had devoted all his time to meditation and had not yet taken the time to explain this to his friends. He thought, My friends have misunderstood me, but I can't worry now about convincing them otherwise. I must devote myself to finding the true path. Once I have found it, I will share it with them. Then he returned to his daily practice. During those same days in which Siddhartha made such great progress along the path, the young buffalo boy, Svasti, appeared. Siddhartha cheerfully accepted the handfuls of fresh grass the 11-year-old boy offered him. Though Sujata, Svasti, and their friends were still children, Siddhartha shared with them some of his new understanding. He was happy to see how unschooled children from the countryside could easily understand his discoveries. He was greatly heartened, for he knew that the door of complete enlightenment would soon open wide. He knew he held the wondrous key, the truth of the interdependent and non-self nature of all things. Chapter 16. Was Yasodhara sleeping? Because he was from a poor family, Svasti had, of course, never gone to school. Sujata taught him a few basics, but he still lacked skill with words, and while recounting his story about the Buddha, he sometimes halted, unable to find the right words. His listeners assisted him. In addition to Ananda and Rahula, two others came to listen to his story. One was an elderly nun named Mahapajapati, and the other was a monk in his early 40s named Asaji. Rahula introduced them both to Svasti, who was deeply touched to learn that Mahapajapati was herself Queen Gotami, the Buddha's aunt who had raised him from infancy. She was the first woman to be accepted as a nun in the Buddha's Sangha, and she now served as abbess to more than 700 nuns. She had just traveled from the north to visit the Buddha and to consult with him concerning precepts for the bhikkhunis. Svasti learned that she had arrived only the previous evening, and her grandson, Rahula, knowing how much she would enjoy hearing all Svasti had to say about the Buddha's days in Uruvela Forest, had invited her to join them. Svasti placed his palms together and bowed low before the abbess. Remembering all the Buddha had told him about her filled his heart with deep affection and respect. Mahapajapati looked at Svasti with the same loving warmth as she looked at her own grandson, Rahula. Rahula introduced Asaji to Svasti, and Svasti's eyes lit up when he learned that Asaji was one of the five friends who had practiced self-mortification with the Buddha near Svasti's own home. The Buddha had told him back then that when his friends saw he had abandoned austerities to drink milk and eat rice, they left him to practice elsewhere. Svasti wondered how Asaji had come to be one of the Buddha's disciples, living here at Bamboo Forest Monastery. He would ask Rahula about it later. Bikini Gotami assisted Svasti the most in his efforts to tell his tale. She asked questions about details that didn't seem important to him, but were of obvious interest to her. She asked where he had cut the kusa grass he offered the Buddha for a meditation cushion, and how often he had provided new bundles of grass for the Buddha. She wanted to know if, after giving the Buddha the grass, the buffalo still had enough to eat at night. And she asked if he was ever beaten by the buffalo's owner. Much remained to be told, but Svasti asked permission to stop there for the evening and promised to continue the following day. But before taking his leave, he wondered if he could ask Bikuni Gotami a few questions that he had held in his heart for 10 years. She smiled at him and said, Go ahead and ask. If I am able to answer your questions, I will be most happy to. There were several things Svasti wanted to know. First of all, had Yasodhara really been sleeping or only pretending to be asleep the night Siddhartha pulled back the curtain before his departure? Svasti also wanted to know what the king, queen, and Yasodhara thought and said when Chana returned with Siddhartha's sword, necklace, and locks of hair. What happened in the lives of the Buddha's family in the 6 years of his absence? Who first heard the news that the Buddha had attained the way? Who first welcomed the Buddha back? And did all the city come out to greet him when he returned to Kapilavata? You do have a lot of questions, exclaimed Bhikkhuni Gotami. She smiled at Svasti. Let me try to answer them briefly. First of all, was Yasodhara truly asleep or not? If you want to know for certain, you should ask Yasodhara. But if you ask me, I don't believe she was. Yasodhara herself had prepared Siddhartha's garments, hat and shoes, and placed them on his chair. She told Chana to saddle and ready Kantaka. She knew that the prince would leave that very night. How could she sleep on such a night? I believe she only pretended to be asleep in order to avoid a painful parting for Siddhartha and herself. You do not yet know Yasodhara, Svasti, but Rahula's mother is a woman of great determination. She understood Siddhartha's intent and quietly gave him her wholehearted support. I know this more clearly than anyone else. For all of those close to Yasodhara, I was the closest, next to Siddhartha. Bhikkhuni Gotami told Svasti that the following morning, when it was discovered that Siddhartha had left, everyone except Yasodhara was in a state of shock. King Suddhodana flew into a rage and yelled at everyone, blaming them for not preventing the prince from leaving. Queen Gotami ran at once to find Yasodhara. She found her sitting quietly and weeping. Official search parties were sent out on horseback in all four directions with orders to return with the prince if they found him. The southbound party met Chana returning with the riderless Kantaka. Chana stopped them from going any further. He said, "Leave the prince in peace to follow his spiritual path. I have already wept and pleaded with him, but he is intent on seeking the way. Anyway, he has entered the deep forests which lie in another country's territory. You cannot seek him there." When Chana returned to the palace, he lowered his head to the ground 3 times as a sign of remorse and took the sword, necklace, and locks of hair to give to the king. At that moment, Queen Gotami and Yasodhara were by the king's side. Seeing Chana's tears, the king did not rebuke him, but slowly asked about all that had taken place. He told Chana to give the sword, necklace, and hair to Yasodhara for safekeeping. The atmosphere in the palace was dreary. Losing the prince was like losing the light of day. The king retired to his quarters and refused to come out for many days. His minister of Assamita was obliged to handle all palace matters on his behalf. After being returned to his stall, Kantaka refused to eat or drink and died a few days later. Overcome with grief, Chana asked Yasodhara's permission to provide a ritual cremation for the prince's horse. Bhikkhuni Gotami had recounted events up to that point when the bell for meditation rang. Everyone looked disappointed, but Ananda said they should not skip meditation no matter how good the stories were. He invited them all to return the following day to his hut. Svasti and Rahula joined their palms and bowed to Bhikkhuni Gotami, Ananda, and Asaji before returning to the hut of their teacher, Sariputta. The two young friends walked side by side without speaking. The slow reverberations of the bell gained momentum like waves breaking one upon another. Svasti followed his breath and silently recited the gatha for hearing the bell. "Listen, listen. This wonderful sound brings me back to my true self."